Hello and welcome to another episode of Diabetes Dialogue, Technology, Therapeutics, and Real World Perspectives. My name is Diana Isaacs, and I am with my co-host, Natalie Bellini. And in this episode, we want to touch upon a few new exciting things. So we're going to talk about some top-line results of the INHALE-1 trial, Catalyst, and we want to start by addressing obesity, which the CDC puts out updated statistics every year. And this is the first time that there was actually a decrease in the rates of obesity. Natalie, can you tell us all about it?
So the CDC does follow rates of obesity in the United States. And we've all seen the obesity maps, and we have all attended a lecture where you see those map colors changing over time. And trust me, they're not going to change from dark, dark red like we see in the Southeast every year to back down to green and say there it's gone. But for the first time in it did decrease slightly. The BMI did decrease slightly in 2023, which is attributed to GLP-1 use. So that in the post-pandemic effects. So that in and of itself is a really big deal. It plateaued in 2022.
Yeah. So the rates of obesity, which is defined as a BMI over 30, went from 46% overall to 45.6%. So it is a very slight decrease. It's not like it was split in half, but it's been going up every single year. So to see it finally not going up and actually going down just slightly is really encouraging. And yes, as you mentioned, the GLP-1 receptor agonists are hypothesized to maybe be part of why this is happening. And I think this is so cool because we've been thinking, oh yeah, it'll probably make a dent in it, but now we're seeing it. And so I'm pretty excited about that.
So, I mean, we do need to mention a couple of things though, right? BMI. When we mentioned BMI, half of the people in the room get all agitated, right? We know it's not a perfect measure. What we do know about BMI is that if someone's very muscular, so if I have a person in front of me that's an athlete that, you know, plays football on the college football team, we don't use BMI. And I actually will note that when I see the person. I will say, BMI 32. This is an inappropriate measure to look at with this athlete who has 0% body fat or 3% body, estimated 3% body fat, those kinds of things, right? We want to make sure, though, that the average person, BMI is okay. It's not perfect, but it's okay. So we've used this measure for quite a long time, though, and it's what we have right now. And so I'm excited about it simply because that measure overall for the majority of people is an okay place to start, right? And then we go deeper into it based on their body build, right? Do they carry more like an apple versus a pear? Do they have central obesity versus what, you know, those kinds of things? This is not a do-all, end-all, be-all. But what I am very excited about is instead of this, we're now like this. For the first time in so long, this gives us hope.
Yeah, I'm very hopeful. And I do think the drugs likely are contributing to this. And with more on their way, like triple agonists and just more in development, I think this is a really encouraging trend. And yes, I agree, BMI is not perfect. Maybe we'll look at body fat. There'll be more markers in the future. But right now, we can still, on a population level, like it's pretty good to as an estimate.
Right. Exactly. That's exactly how I feel. So very exciting news.
Next, let's talk about the INHALE-1 study. So this was Afrezza in pediatrics, and this was designed as a non-inferiority study to really hopefully gain the approval for use of inhaled insulin in the pediatric population. So this included people with type 1 and type 2 diabetes that were under 18, and basically compared the use of long-acting insulin with Afrezza to their usual previous routine of multiple daily injections with a rapid-acting insulin and long-acting insulin. And Natalie, you want to share the top-line results?
Sure. So real quick, though. So there were 230 children, up to 18, were randomized to this study. the control group on MDI used the rapid acting insulin analogs. So, and then in combination with their basal insulin, while the treatment group used Afrezza in combination with basal insulin. And at 26 weeks, all the participants entered an extension phase in which the remaining MDI patients were switched to Afrezza. And that part of the, that arm is still active right now. That phase of the trial is still active. So at week 26, the Afrezza group achieved a mean, a similar A1C, numerically up from at 8.4%, up from 8.2 at baseline, compared to 8.2 in the control group. So it's pretty much the same, but and a little bit higher. And you go, oh, wait, it's a little bit higher. Why would I ever use it then? Well, the challenge was there was a person with diabetes in the study that had a very high A1C of 15%. And when you do these kinds of studies, they actually have dose recorders on the equipment so that they know when the person is taking the insulin. And obviously, most of us understand that if someone ends up with an A1C of 15, they're not taking all the doses. So they pulled that person out of the study and did an analysis again called a modified ITT analysis that excluded that one person. And then the 95% confidence interval was below 0.4, meeting that non-inferiority margin. What does that tell us? People who don't take insulin really can skew our data, can't they, right? So when we look at this as a non-inferiority study, again, just like you said, we want this approved. And so what you do is when we look at those ultra-long-acting basals, right, they were compared to insulin glargine. Well, now we're comparing Afrezza to that rapid-acting insulin analogs and saying they're not inferior. Someone could use one or the other and get similar or the same results. I do want to call out a couple of things, which are the important parts, right? There were no differences in lung function, which I think we all worry, you know, you go, oh, you're going to inhale, you only have one set of lungs. Nope, no difference in lung function. And as well as no increased hypoglycemia. So to me, as a person who prescribes medications, those are the two big ones when I think of Afrezza. Am I going to have more lows, number one? And am I going to have lung issues? And the answer put to both of those in this INHALE-3 study, the answer was no.
Yeah, I mean, I think that is really key, showing the safety with the lung function. My hope is that we could get rid of even the requirements for the FEV1 testing prior to use and ongoing, because that, I think, is a barrier to the uptake of it and more people not using it. So that's great to see. And I'm all about having options. So I think it would be really nice to have this available. I mean, we know some kids are using it already. It's just the issue is it's harder to get when you don't have an indication for it. It's very easy for insurance companies to deny it, to being able to access it. So,
and I also think, especially in that pediatric population, I think prescribers are a little bit more like, oh, it's not approved for peds. Should I do it? Should I not do it? Because they're kids, right? And I think that it will open up some doors for these kids to use insulin that works very, very quickly, especially when, you know, think about a child that wants to play on the soccer team. They go do it, and then they go to some awful yogurt, dairy, whatever it is, place and want a slushy with ice cream in it. And there's no way rapid-acting injectable insulin, you know, can cover that as well as inhaled insulin, right? We know that those kids who want some higher carbohydrate foods because that's what they love, this really can make a huge difference to that population. Never mind convenience, right? Some people, adults and children, they never want a pump. They don't want something stuck to them. They don't want any part of those kinds of things. This is really going to make a difference for those families that just want, you can treat often and really keep glucoses in target and not, especially with those kids with injection fears, with those kids that just, you know, eat a little bit here and there. I can see all kinds of options for it.
Yeah. So I look forward, this is to the final results. This is an interim analysis at 26 weeks. It's a 52-week study. And then these are top-line results. So we'll be waiting on the full publication and the presentation of results at an upcoming scientific meeting. And the next thing we want to talk about is the most recent Catalyst data. So this was presented at the World Congress on Insulin Resistance, Diabetes, and Cardiovascular Disease, which was held December 12th to 14th. And in this presentation, So this was a follow-up actually to part one, where they just looked at, okay, what are the rates of hypercortisolism in people with kind of what they call difficult to manage type 2 diabetes that had A1Cs over 7.5%, were on two or more glucose-lowering medications. And that was impressive data because they showed that 24% actually had hypercortisolism. So the second step to that was then they used the drug Korlym or mifepristone and saw, okay, is that, did that drug make a difference in terms of affecting A1C? And it turns out, boy, did it make a difference. It actually decreased the A1C by 1.5% compared to the control group, which decreased A1C by 0.2%. So a huge difference. And they were starting off with a mean A1C of 8.6%. So 1.5% A1C reduction. Natalie, what do you think about this?
So I think this is really incredible. When the first part of Catalyst was read out at ADA in 2024, I think we all looked at each other and said, wow, because we always think of hypercortisolism as a very rare disease. And when I teach this, I say, close your eyes and look at that hypercortisolism patient in your or person in your textbook and then tear out that page. Because by the time they present as what it's drawn in your textbook to look like, it's too late. They have an increased risk of cardiovascular disease. They have a shorter life expectancy. They have, and those symptoms shouldn't be that dramatic, right? So we should be screening earlier, but then what do we do about it, right? So the first thing we do is try to figure out, is there something that is an adrenal issue where we can take it out, right? Is there a tumor that we can just take out and everything gets better? Is there a pituitary issue and is that a challenge? And then we say for lots of these people, we can't operate because they're not surgical candidates or it's nowhere, but we know it's somewhere, right? And this is where endocrine tumors are strange. So we can use this medication on those people. And it's not for everybody. It's for the people that we don't have an isolated tumor, that we don't know where it's coming from necessarily, or we can't operate. Sometimes we'll even use it when a person isn't a surgical candidate right now, and we know there's a problem, but we can actually use it to bring down that hemoglobin A1C to reduce that risk of infection and surgical complications. But the idea that we had these 136 people who tested positive for hypercortisolism in the first part of that study, their treatment was for 24 weeks. So 6 months of time, an A1C reduction of 1.5% compared to a 0.2% A1C reduction with a placebo from the baseline of 8.4. This is a wow. This, Diana, to me was like, what? What just happened? I mean, we all knew that it would probably help somewhat because we've used the medication and here we are. But this is incredible.
This is truly incredible. I mean, this is so practice changing. I think just the fact that the 24% are even eligible for this, because it describes so much of our population, the over 7.5% A1C on two or more meds, like so much of the population. So to think that a quarter of those had hypercortisolism, and then those types of people benefit from taking this. I mean, it's huge because even though we have great therapies, we have GLP-1 receptor agonists and SGLT2 inhibitors, we know that some people don't respond to them, or they're taking them and they're still requiring so much insulin, and it's like it's just not helping them. And so it just makes me really wonder now, all those patients that aren't responding the way that we think that they should or are outliers, that they could actually have hypercortisolism. I mean, this is really just huge for practice.
It is. And I think, you know, we think about testing for hypercortisolism and going, oh, there's this saliva test and they're so picky and blah, blah, blah. We are exclusively in our practice using overnight dexamethasone suppression to start at least. And it is helping a lot to just make it easy. You take this pill around 11 o'clock at night, you know, go straight to bed, wake up in the morning, go straight to the lab, and you draw the cortisol level as well as the dexamethasone level. I need to make sure that the dexamethasone level is in range, that they took it, number one, but number two, that it isn't that they didn't need a higher level to suppress, right? So we're making the screening easier. We used to have all these different steps. And yes, we may have to get to some of them in between, but we don't have to do all of them at first. So the screening has become easier and more standardized. And, you know, I think that a big part of this, you know, we Dr. DeFranzo, actually, who came up with the ominous octet that kind of changed my career and where I focused on diabetes in general, said, this ominous octet, maybe I really need to make this, he calls it the noxious nine, right? With inclusion of this hypercortisolism, where this is maybe more important than any of us ever realized.
It's so exciting. I can't wait to see. So with all those exciting updates, that wraps up this episode of Diabetes Dialogue. We can't wait to catch you next time.